There's no such thing as double play depth when Vladimir Guerrero and Mark McGwire were hitting. There was two players you do not play double play depth on, and that was those two guys.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, I'm talking to 12-year big league veteran Wes Helms. We talk his long big league career, breaking in during the heyday of the late 90s, early aughts Braves, all the way to finishing up as a veteran presence on the rebuilding Marlins. We also talk about the road to get there, learning to make adjustments at every stop in the minor leagues, and the importance of learning how to be the best role player you can be. It's also a great Remember Some Guys episode, as Wes talks playing with the teenage Andrew Jones, playing with the peak Chipper Jones, watching Richie Sexton take BP, and stepping into the box against Randy Johnson. Really good look back at Wes's career, really happy he could join. Episodes of From Phenom to the Farm drop every other month. If you enjoyed this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA Podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. It's Rule 5 fever season. Shout out to J.J. Cooper for his favorite time of the year. And it's also Top 10 Prospect season. New Top 10 Prospects list dropping every day over at BA. It is always a good time to be a subscriber. And with that, let's talk to Wes Helms. All right, joining in for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm, he's a 10th round pick of the Braves in the 1994 draft, former big league third baseman Wes Helms. Wes, thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thanks for asking me. Looking forward to it.
I'm looking forward to it, too, as someone who watched a lot of Braves on TBS growing up. So this will be a treat for me. But before we jump in, tell me about Camwood Bats and what you're doing now.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm the CEO of Camwood Bats now. I was the first major leaguer to use the training bat that the Hands of Speed trainer we have. That's what built the company. I got to know the original owner, Frank Gregory, and now he's kind of older. He's in his 60s, and, you know, he turned it over to a younger guy, Trey Sykes, and Trey Sykes owns it. He brought me on board about almost 4 years ago. I was like, hey, man, I want you to run the company. I want you to be the CEO. You're so good with people. You're so good with managing things. Like, and plus with your name in the baseball world, like, you're going to have a lot of credibility of pushing the products because we know they work, but people are going to listen to you. So it kind of fell in my lap a little bit just by being the first guy to use the training mat, just by knowing the original owner. And then once Trey took over, you know, he pulled the trigger and was like, look, I want you to be full go. So it's been one of the best things that's ever happened to me, but also it's been really good for Camwood as well. So it's kind of, we've killed two birds with one stone. Give me something to do, and also I get to grow a company that Trey knew I could help him grow.
That is the thing we talk about on the show a lot with guys, is what to do when you're done playing, which is a tough question for a lot, especially a guy like you who came out of high school. So we can dive right into that. Like, you're coming up in North Carolina in the early 90s. When did you first realize you were going to have a chance to play baseball after high school?
So I knew I was good in junior high. I mean, I was the best player in the area there in Gastonia. And, you know, is Kevin Millwood, myself, which Kevin played pro as well. And
so we're going to remember some guys today, and that's a guy, man. Kevin Millwood.
Yeah, Kevin was a year older than me, but it was him and I battling back and forth all the time. He was in Bessemer City, and I was in Gastonia, and, you know, we were the two guys. We were the two dudes, and what happened was, I would say, when I went to high school, it was 10th, 11th, and 12th. It wasn't 9th grade freshman or anything. So when I got into the 10th grade, it started kind of hitting because I saw a few pro scouts here and there. Then all of a sudden, my junior year, my first game of my junior year, I noticed there was a lot of scouts in the stands. And, you know, I noticed that, you know, just started getting the word around, started there was a buzz in the air, and there was a feeling. So then I knew then I had a chance to go pro. And, you know, it wasn't like today where everything's on social media and the news. I mean, nobody talked about it. If it wasn't in the local newspaper, you didn't have any clue what was going on in the rest of the United States when it come to players. So, you know, nowadays it would have been a lot easier for me to kind of know where I would have been drafted maybe, or this or that. And so it came, I went through my junior year, had a great year, got co-North Carolina State Player of the Year with Trot Nixon.
Oh.
And then played Legion ball. The start of my senior year, it was 26 scouts in the stands my first game. And that's when it really hit me, like, okay, this is going to happen. I mean, all I got to do is go take care of what I need to on the field. Went out there, had a great senior year, got drafted in the 10th round in June. The draft was like the first week or two of June back then. So,
were you dead set on pro ball, or had you made a commit? Like, did you have a fallback option you wanted to go to, or were you like, let's make this pro thing happen?
that's a good point. I kind of skipped that. My junior year, I signed a full scholarship with North Carolina at Chapel Hill. That was I loved North Carolina growing up. I was a Tar Heel fan, basketball, with Jordan and everybody that had come through there. I followed them, and it was a dream come true. So it was kind of hard as I got closer to it to see, like, okay, this could become a reality. And then when I did get drafted, my parents and I sat down, and I'll never forget it. My dad, they were both big on education, but my dad said, look, you can always go to college. Your mind is going to be there, but your body's not always going to be there. Like, why not go give this a shot? You're mature for your age. You outwork everybody. Go outwork everybody and see how far it takes you. And if it doesn't, then you can always fall back on college. So we had the Atlanta Braves. They put in my contract. They would pay for 4 years of college if I did not make it to the major leagues. So that didn't work out for either side. So I made it to the big leagues and played 12 years in the major leagues. So it was all worth it. But that was one of the hardest decisions, was should I go to college or should I not? And it was just my dad saying those few things that made me realize, like, yes, I need to go try this.
So that first you get like a cup of coffee in 98, like 7 games. Did that trigger that they'd no longer pay for college, just those 7 games?
To be honest with you, I don't know the rules of it. I think it has to be a certain amount of days in the big leagues, because that kind of keeps the teams away from calling a guy up, sending him back down, he never makes it again. There is a stipulation in there. I mean, I could look it up, but I don't think that would have been the case. I think you have to spend like at least a year in the big leagues, maybe, or close to a year. It's kind of like the pay scale of arbitration. You have to be there so long before you hit arbitration and stuff like that. So, I think I would have had to been there for a little bit of time before they could have said, no, we're not paying for your college.
What was the draft experience like in 94? Because obviously way pre-televised, way, it's pre-internet, you can't follow it. Like, for guys now, the 10th round is a long wait. For you, are you, were you sitting by the phone, or was it just this thing, this is going on, it's going to happen at some point?
No, it's actually a good question. I kind of tell this story. I actually was at Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, on my senior trip with some buddies of mine, my good friend Lee Du Bois, and which he still lives in Gastonia. And we went to the beach. And back then, there's no cell phone, so when you call home, you had to use the pay phone to call home. So I always would call and check in. I mean, I knew the draft was going to happen, but I mean, I was a senior. I was going to the beach. My mind was on other things at that time. Next thing I call home, and my mom and dad answer the phone, and they literally were like, "You just got drafted by the Atlanta Braves." So we talked on the phone for a minute. I'll never forget it. Lee and I hopped in the car and headed back to Gastonia, and I got back to Gastonia, and within 2 or 3 days, I was on a plane to West Palm Beach, Florida, which was where the rookie or where the spring training was for the Braves at the time, because it was the Braves and the Expos that shared the complex there in West Palm. And yeah, it didn't take long at all, but yeah, I had no idea what round I was going in. I mean, who was going to draft me? I kind of had an idea it was going to be the Marlins or the Braves, just because Roy Clark, the scout for the Braves,
Kind of funny how
was
that works
around.
out then, with you ending up with the Marlins for so long.
Oh, I know, it's crazy, because the Marlins wanted me as a pitcher, because I was a really good pitcher in high school. But I kind of come out and said I didn't want to pitch. I wanted to play every day and hit. So I think that kind of squashed it a little bit. But the Braves, Roy Clark was around all the time. So you had that in your mind, like, hey, I see this guy here every single game. So you knew that there was something to that.
Did you buy anything with the first bonus check?
Did not, no. I mean, we grew up blue collar. My mom and dad were blue collar, and I did, and I put it in the bank, signed for $100,000, put it in the bank, and no, never really did. I had my vehicle from my parents buying it in high school, and I kept that for a while. And no, I don't think I really made a purchase for anything that would be like a vehicle or anything until I think I was in AAA, and I switched my car to a Ford Expedition. But other than that, no, I wasn't a big money spender, because I grew up blue collar, and I just loved baseball, and that's all I cared about doing.
That was good. I'm sure those $7 GCL checks didn't spend those either.
Yeah, I will say this. You know, minor leaguers nowadays don't want to hear it, but minor leaguers have it now, made now. We did not have it made at all. I mean, our checks every 2 weeks, I mean, you would laugh at it nowadays if you even thought about it. The food we got was, you know, not the best. Like, it was.
I think the housing is the big thing. The housing is the big thing. That's huge.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, we had to do all that. We had to fend for ourselves. I mean, but also it made us grow up a lot faster. It made us mature faster because we had to budget. We had to be responsible, you know. I mean, it was just a different time, a different era. But, yeah, it was hard. Minor leagues were not glamorous at all, and minor leagues were a grind when I played, for sure.
Did you ever have a time where you were like, man, playing in the ACC would be great right about now?
You know, I thought about it. I mean, because North Carolina, you know, I mean, I just, like I said, I grew up a Tar Heel fan. When I first got drafted, I thought about the college experience a little bit here and there. I mean, I would go down there. Lee, my buddy, went there. I would go visit him, or I would go to Clemson to visit a guy that I went, or one of my other friends I went to high school with. So I kind of got to experience a little bit of the college life. But yeah, I mean, to play college baseball, just to say you played it at that level, you know, in those kind of conferences, I mean, that speaks for itself. But like I said, I mean, it worked out for me, but there were times I thought about it.
You signed early enough to get 56 games in the GCL. I have heard the GCL described as like the baseball version of the prison from Cool Hand Luke. I'm curious, as an 18-year-old, you know, you're wearing Braves gear, like you're a professional. Is there some more aura versus if you're coming from like a North Carolina and going to the GCL, or is it still just the most humid grind in baseball?
No, it was grind. I mean, it was, and you know, I had Eddie Watt and all these coaches that were just old school coaches that were all about, you know, you're going to outwork everybody else and we're going to run you through the grind. It was almost like boot camp, to be honest with you. But I mean, it was, you know, 6:30, 7 a.m. You're on the field by 9, and then you're running through a full workout to 11:30, and then you're coming in eating lunch, playing a game at 1. And 1 o'clock in Florida is not the funnest time to play in the middle of the summer in June and July. So it was 100% eye-opening experience when it comes to it. It's every day. You know, in high school, you play, you have practice the other days, and then you play. Like, this was every single day the same thing. The same practices, game, you know, then you go eat dinner, go to bed, and you get up and do it again. It was like Groundhog Day. So it was, like I said, yeah, it was a grind. There was nothing special about it. It was fun, but it wasn't anything you write home to your mom about saying like, hey, this is easy. It's not easy.
Your first full year, you do the full year in Macon. They send you out to full season ball at, you know, at 19. Do you think you would have been prepared for that had you not done the GCL? Say you'd been a holdout guy, you sign, you do instructs and then spring training. Like, did it prepare you for full season ball better?
100%. That's actually a great question, because that's one of the things in today's game that I do not agree with, is they rush players. When I was with the Braves, they had kind of a rule, and this was across the minor leagues. You didn't see guys get rushed. I mean, I came up with Andrew Jones.
I was going to ask about teenage Andrew Jones.
Well, I mean, I'll use him as an example right now. Is like, he was ready to make those jumps before he did, but the Braves would not do that to players. They wanted you to mature at each level, have a certain amount of at-bats at each level before you jump. Now, you know, I see guys hitting 180 and they have 100 at-bats in A-ball and they jump to double-A, and it's like they're not ready yet. They need that grind. They need that experience of overcoming that failure and figuring things out. So 100%, the GCL prepared me for Macon. It prepared me for that first full season of 142 games, and it made me tougher. It made me my body be able to withstand that length of that season. But it was because of the way those coaches trained us and prepared us every single day that made it happen. And I, you know, I was blessed to be able to come up in that era, because each level we made it to, we were ready. There wasn't, hey, let me get sent back down and, you know, try to figure it out, because, you know, they had you ready or you weren't making that jump.
What was watching teenage Andrew Jones, like I'd say 2 years before he just breaks out in the World Series and becomes a star.
It was unreal. Like I tell people all the time, and Andrew and I still keep in touch. Like it was like watching Sandlot baseball. Like you just in your backyard playing baseball effortlessly, no worry in the world, and just really good at it. And it was watching him play. It was just so effortless, so fluent. Like the way he was at the plate, his base running, his outfield. He was just so polished at a young age. It was incredible watching this guy. I mean, by far, in my opinion, the best center fielder I've ever seen in the game since I've been around. I mean, I know Willie Mays and all of them were really good, but like I'm speaking Mike Trout or anybody, Andrew Jones is the best center fielder I've ever laid eyes on to play the game of baseball. Like the stuff that he could do in the outfield was unreal. The stuff that he would do just at the plate and on the bases, like he had those instinctual things that you don't, like it's hard to teach. Those things are just embedded in you from birth, and he had those. And, you know, it was so much fun to get to play with that guy and watch, you know, every day how he went about his business. You know, some people, he got the knock early, like he didn't care. I'm like, no, that's just Andrew. Like he cares. He's just that good. It looks like he don't care because he's so effortless in everything he does.
I'm hoping this year is the year for him to get into the Hall of Fame. There's not really like a great first time class, and he gets knocked for essentially being done at like 30. But if you look at the career he put up to at 30, like he has a higher B war than a bunch of Hall of Famers, and he basically stopped putting up war at 30, which is incredible.
No, he needs to be in there 100%. I know the sports writers and all them have their reasons, but when you play alongside that guy and you see the amount of runs he saved the team and pitchers and what he did at the plate and what he could do on the bases, even to get in scoring position for the next guy, like those, he's a Hall of Famer. He's the best center fielder of that era, and that's what it means to be a Hall of Famer is you're the best player of your era, and he was by far one of the best players of the era he played in.
And was a guy who could hit 40 home runs, which is pretty 100%. Good too. Pretty good too. Most minor league towns, I'd imagine, are kind of like whatever. You know, no one grows up dreaming of playing for the Macon Braves. Is that different at all when you play for Durham? You're playing for Durham like 8 years after Bull Durham comes out. Was that in your mind at all, or is it just another stop on the way to Atlanta?
Honestly, that's a good point. Macon, you're right. I mean, there was nothing special about Macon. I mean, you know, the park was a park. There was nothing special about the park. But you go to Durham, there's history behind it with the movie. You know, I didn't play in the old stadium. I played the new one. And even now, the new one's like a mini big league park. But like stepping foot that first day in 1996 on the field at Durham with me and Andrew and Ron Wright and all of us, like that was special. That was the first time you realized, like, I'm a professional ball player. Like, this is different because every time all of that up into Durham, you know, you felt, like I said, you were in the military playing baseball. And now it's like, this is awesome. The stadium's beautiful. It was packed out. You know, the fans loved it because they had a new stadium. That was the first time you realized, like, okay, this is professional baseball. This is a little glimpse of what the big leagues will be times 50. So
you talk about being ready kind of level to level in those things. As you get, you know, you get a couple seasons under your belt. You know, once you hit like Double A, what did you kind of envision your path to the big leagues was, and what were those things of like, okay, I'm this guy in Double A, what do I need to tack onto my game to become a big leaguer? Like what were you working on? What was your focus?
Well, the biggest thing for me was defense. You know, that was the one thing I needed to polish up, being a third baseman, being an infielder. Also realizing the player I was, like, you know, I had a lot of power, but my swing and everything was geared more toward gap to gap. So I realized the player kind of when I got to Double A, almost going into Triple A, like, okay, this is the player I'm going to be, and I need to really focus on being the best version of me. And that was drive balls in the gap, not trying to hit the ball out of the park. You know, because I knew if I caught it right, I was going to hit it out because I had the power to do it. But it was basically, you find out the player you're going to be. And Charlie Manuel always said this when I was in Philly, like, know thyself. I think that's one of the best things for any player, but that's what I thought when I was in double A, going into triple A, is I got to know who I am and I got to know the player I am. I can't try to be like anybody else. And about the double A levels, when you kind of see the player that you're going to be, and you just, that's when I realized I just need to really focus on making myself the best version of me, making myself the best defender on the infield. And also just, doing the things that I had to do every single day to help my team win, because I knew that's what I was going to have to do in the big leagues. I wasn't going to be the guy that hit 30 to 40 homers. I was going to be the guy that hit probably 10 to 15. I know I hit 23 one year in Milwaukee, but I knew the player I was, and I just worked to be the best version of that.
So that wasn't a lot of your BA scouting reports was, above average power, but not getting to it as much in games, like having a different swing geared to it. Do you think, say, if you were coming up now with how baseball has shifted, how development has shifted, do you think that would have led to a swing change or a approach change of, taking more walks, striking out more, but trying to drive the ball out of the ballpark more? Like, do you think you would have taken that upon yourself to shift? Do you think it would have been forced upon you? Like, curious, you had that raw power. Do you think that would have been something that would have been almost forced on you to tap into more?
I agree. Yeah, I do agree. I think in today's game, there's way more information that organizations have and players have to be able to make them better in certain aspects of the game. And like you said, I had the power to do that, but in the game, it didn't show up like, maybe some have wanted. Where now in today's game, they could have probably brought me in to the hit lab and we talked about it. And we could have made some slight tweaks and some things in the way my body would move to the ball on my swing, to now those doubles are going to become homers. And that's why I think the information in today's game is so great, because it allows the player to become the best version of themselves, what they're supposed to be. And if they're not, you get information to get it there. And where when we played, we didn't have all of those instruments and measuring things to figure out all the way out and the stuff they put on the bodies of how the body moves and everything. So I 100% think in today's game that whatever organization I would be with in today's game would say, Wes, here's what we need to do, because here's what we see you can do.
97, you tear it up in Greenville. You go to Richmond for the back end of that season. My growing up, my hometown. I grew up in Richmond, so a lot of our Braves games. Probably saw you on the our Braves at some point. And then it's a tough stretch initially, but the 98, you go back to Richmond and you turn in a great year. Like, frankly, what gives? Was it just like kind of a tough month? Maybe some things didn't fall your way, or in that small sample size, those 32 games, did you learn something that allowed you to be better in 98?
100%, I learned how they were going to pitch me. I mean, up until that point, I mean, double A, you start getting into, okay, pitchers are starting to figure out how to pitch. Triple A, they know how to pitch, and you have big leaguers and all up and down. So, it's more of a mature level in Triple A than it is even in double A. So that being said, I had to make an adjustment, because I went up there, I saw they were pitching me totally different than in double A. I had to make an adjustment, but it took time to make that adjustment. It took experience. It took the at bats for me to formulate, okay, this is what I need to do and make the adjustment because of the way they're pitching me. They see something that I am doing wrong. They see a weakness and they're pounding it. So I got to flip the script and change my approach. And it took time. My first stint in AAA, yeah, it was up and down, and it was basically me figuring out, at that level what I needed to do. But that goes back to what I said earlier. Like, that was part of the process, and it takes time at each level to figure out different things, because, rookie ball, A ball, you got throwers. Double A, you have throwers that are figuring out how to pitch. Triple A, you have pitchers. And there's a difference. And I had to figure out myself as a hitter how to adjust to the pitchers. And it took me a while, but then when I went there in 98, I went in with the plan and it worked, and I had a really good season that year.
What were those things that they were doing differently? Like, what did you see in AAA that you hadn't been seeing as much in AA?
So basically, what they were doing, they were throwing me soft, they were pitching me soft, down away, soft away, and they were pounding me in with the fastball. And up until that point, they were, majority hard. on everything. And then if they threw off speed, a lot of them didn't know how to pinpoint where it would go. So they would leave pitches over the plate in areas that I would, you know, hit well. Up there, they know how to locate better. So they were locating that off speed better, and they were locating the fastball better. So they knew where they wanted to put that fastball on me because they knew I was a right center gap hitter, center to right center. That was my bread and butter. And so they got me in, but then they knew I was probably going to try to get to that. So it was soft down and away. So that's when I learned that I needed to flip my approach and I needed to stay middle of the field, but I had to sit on certain pitches. So I would go up there and start eliminating pitches. Like I would eliminate the soft down the way until I got two strikes, and I would just sit on the hard end, or vice versa. I would sit on the all speed away or down away, and I would, you know, not hit swing at the fastball in until two strikes. So it was more of an approach change of eliminating pitches, setting certain zones until two strikes. And but that's how you have to hit at the AAA and big league level. I mean, the arms are too good, and not only the arms are too good, they know where to put it. And so that was the big thing with me, was just going up there sitting on certain pitches till I got to two strikes.
So by the high minors, you would put yourself, your Braves top prospect. I can't think of a worse organization to be a top third base prospect in the late 90s than the Atlanta Braves. How much does that, like, how much are you thinking about that the my main position is blocked by future Hall of Famer Chipper Jones? Like, do you start thinking about, man, maybe like around the trade deadline, it's like, man, I would make a great piece for a trade or something like that? Or does it, how much does it matter, really? Like, how much are you thinking about next man up?
I mean, you do think about it. I mean, everybody does. I mean, you know, we're all team players, but we're also competitors. I mean, we want our shot. We want to be able to help the organization win, and we know we can do that. And on the flip side, it's your career. This is a job. So, you know, you got to be on the field to be able to eventually get the contracts you need and all that kind of, you know, there's a lot that goes through the process of it. But having Chipper there was definitely a roadblock for me. But it was also a good roadblock because, you know, I would rather be in a position I was with Chipper there in a top-notch organization that did everything by the book, and they basically did things the right way of how you play the game, how you act, you know, how you present yourself on and off the field. It was the Braves way. So I'd rather be where I was than with a team that didn't care about some of that other stuff, and, you know, the team wasn't good, and I was up there earlier and, you know, maybe would have made more money or had a long, you know, played longer. But you know what? I would rather have been in the position I was because it taught me the right way to do things in the big leagues. And, you know, that being said, I mean, you do think about it. You do think about Chipper Jones is in front of you. It's like, okay, I'm down here in AAA really doing well. But, you know, that was the different times. Nowadays, those young kids are getting moved up no matter what. They'll find a position for them or whatever. But back when I was there, you know, you had to earn your spot. And, you know, I was blessed to come up in that era.
Did that get floated to you at all? Like, hey, maybe, because you ended up, you played around a little bit as you got into the big leagues. Like, did that get floated to you down in the minors? Like, hey, start thinking about first base, start thinking about left field. Like, you know, what does that come up? Or are they just like, you're a third baseman, and when we have a job for you, you'll be up there?
Yeah, I didn't really play any other positions in the minors. The only time I played, I didn't play first base until I got hurt in the big leagues. But I mean, when I went down the minor leagues for rehab, but in the minor leagues, I was just third base. I mean, there was no, let's do first base, let's do, you know, outfield. I mean, it was third base. And, you know, I do think I wish, now that's the one thing I wish, maybe, like, hey, let me move over to here, or let me try left or right field or whatever. But that didn't happen. I think, you know, they had me stuck at third. They saw me as a third baseman. And, you know, I guess they also had their mind of Chipper maybe moving to left, which he did eventually. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that went into play. That's why they always say, don't play GM, just go play. Because if you start playing GM, you're going to drive yourself crazy. But yeah, there are times you think about it, like, hey, what if I was in another position? Could that open up a spot for me?
Support for this podcast is brought to you by Walden University. Ever catch yourself thinking, what if I could go after what I actually want and really make a difference? You're not alone, and that's exactly why I want to tell you about Walden University. For over 50 years, Walden has helped working adults like you get the W with the knowledge and skills to build the future you want and make a difference where it matters most. If you've been waiting for the right moment, this is it. Head to waldenu.edu and take that first step. Walden University, set a course for change, certified to operate by Chev.
Walk me through that first call up.
So actually, I was in Richmond. The team, Atlanta, was in St. Louis. I think it was the night before Chipper kind of tweaked his oblique a little bit on a swing. Nothing severe. He didn't come out of the game. But as a cost precautionary, they were like, okay, we need to get Wes here. So Jim Lovell was the trainer in Richmond. And so back then, there was no cell phones or anything. So he calls me at the house I was staying in. I was staying at a family's up there in Richmond. And I answer the phone, and Jim's like, hey, you're on a 4 o'clock flight to St. Louis.
St. Louis in 1998, which was a happening place to be in 1998.
Right in the middle of the McGuire and Sosa home run chase. That being said, I was going to land in St. Louis, get off the plane, go straight to the field, put on my uniform, and basically hopefully be there by the first inning. And it wasn't your typical call-up of let's get there, let's take BP. I mean, it was like get the uniform on and be ready. So Chipper was going to play that night. He was fine, but I got to St. Louis, got my uniform on, and I'll never forget. I walked out. I got there as the players were warming up, so I did get there before the first pitch, and I walked out there, and it was sold out. I mean, sold out.
I was going to say, I'm sure that was a – I don't know what number he was on at that point, but I'm sure by that point it was everyone in the seats.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, because that was in August, I mean, he was already, you know, I think 50. I mean, he was in his low 50s, if I'm not mistaken. And just the amount of fans that were within that stadium, I was like, I've never in my life seen this many people in one spot. And it was crazy to just witness him at the plate. And I think it was his second at bat. Dave Martinez was pitching. And I remember McGuire hit one dead center field. And I'm just like, this is unreal. Like, this is a different animal up here. And it made me realize, like, this is a grown man's league. And it made me grow up quick because I was 21 years old and I'm just watching what was going on and witnessing all this. And I'm like, yeah, this is a different animal. You got to grow up really fast.
And you got to sit at third base when that man is up, which seems like a questionable, a nerve-wracking thing when a guy that big is hitting balls that hard and you are the closest person to him besides the pitcher.
There's no such thing as double play depth when Vladimir Guerrero and Mark McGuire were hitting. There was two players you do not play double play depth on, and that was those two guys. And you played back basically where you do with nobody on, nobody out, because, well, first of all, you know, McGuire's not going to be the fastest guy, so you can still turn double play. But those two guys were the scariest guys. If you even thought about moving in some, no, you don't do that on those guys. They hit the ball way too hard, and it was coming in hot. You know, the way McGuire's swing was geared, it's like, okay, he don't hit many pull side ground balls. Everything in pull side's in the air and it's out of the park. But if he does pull it on the ground, it's going to have top spin. And it's going to be coming about 110 to 115 with top spin. And that's not fun for a third baseman.
Would you rather be playing third base and that guy's up, or like Juan Pierre is up? And it's, I got to be on my toes.
So that's a great question. 100% McGuire, because you know he's not going to bunt. The two that I could say is Juan Pierre and Craig Biggio. Those two guys, like if you gave them any depth, they're going to bunt. I mean, and if you played it on the grass, they were going to absolutely try to – Pierre's going to try to slice it by you, and Biggio's going to turn and burn. I mean, Biggio gets right on the plate, and he will turn and burn on that ball. He'll see you playing in. And 100% would rather play with the big donkeys at the plate at third base than those guys that can lay it down or also can, like, Biggio didn't hit the ball weakly. I mean,
he had 3,000 hits. Like, he had pop.
Oh, yeah, he could hit it. So, that being said, 100%, when the big donkeys are up, I'll play there all day long. But the guys that give you fits on bunting and slapping, you know, like running, like the for call running slap or whatever they did, yeah, those guys would kill you over there at third base.
the Braves were a different level of notable in the South, I would say, at that. Like, this is pre, you know, MLB TV and stuff like that. Like, them with TBS and the Cubs with WGN, like, were always on. So that those teams just, you know, a Wes Helms, a Keith Lockhart, and Eddie Perez is probably a more, quote-unquote, famous baseball player than, like, a regular for the Pirates. Is there a thing to that? Like, did you see benefits from that? Or did you notice that, like, hey, we have a bigger following than most of these other teams? Or is that by the time you get to the big leagues, you know, it doesn't really matter?
No, back then, I definitely think back in that era when it was TBS and WGN, I think for sure the Cubs and the Braves were the most popular teams other than the Yankees. The Yankees have always been popular, but I think the Braves, you know, with them with TBS, I mean, everybody in the United States knew them. And, you know, wherever we went to play in places, I mean, it would sell out and almost be sold out because of that reason. And then the Cubs were the same way. You know, that's what people watched on TV. So, you know, people across the country knew every player on the Braves team. I mean, they knew all of us from Chipper, the superstars, all the way down to the 25th man on the team. So, you know, that was all people watched. So I think nowadays people have the availability to watch all different kind of teams, where then it was Braves and Cubs, so everybody knew the players on the Braves and Cubs.
I want to remember some guys on these early Braves teams you came up with, because watching Chipper Jones play, what can you pull from a guy like that? And curious, like, you talk about, like, great players, McGuire, Vlad Guerrero, Chipper Jones, as you are a guy kind of like more of a role player in your time with Atlanta, like, what are you pulling from guys like Chipper who, what can you learn from a guy who's at the top of his game?
Just consistency. Like, Chipper was consistent day in and day out. Like, it was, he did his thing, but, like, you know, he had great seasons, MVP seasons, put up unreal numbers, Hall of Famer, but it was almost like when you played with him every single day, it was just consistent. It wasn't like a roller coaster, like, oh my God, one day he's 4-for-4 with two homers, and the next day he's 1-for-4 with a single. Like, it was, every night you felt like the guy got two hits, and it was just consistent. Guys on base, he's getting them in. Like, it was, you know, almost like he was just a creature of habit every single day. And that's the one thing that stood out to me about him was, you know, it wasn't a roller coaster career. It wasn't a roller coaster season with him when I played with him. It was every day he did something to help the Braves win. I mean, yeah, he struck out. Yeah, he made his errors. Yeah, that's going to happen. But it was like when you sit back and just think about playing with him, like, you're like, it always seemed like there was some situation that Chipper was at the plate and the job got done. And that's all you remember. It's he was consistent every single day. So I always try to mold myself after him would be the most consistent player I can be, which consistency is huge, especially at the big league level.
What's playing third base next to Rafael for call like?
Well, I didn't have to have much range to my left. I mean, the guy covered so much ground, and I mean, you know, I mean, honestly, you'd rather, if you go to your left and he gets a backhand, I mean, he's going to throw the guy out. He threw 100 miles an hour across the infield. So, yeah, it was fun. I mean, watching him, I mean, like I said, I mean, he was just a little spark plug. He was a little energizer bunny that got to everything. So, I mean, when you played with him, you know, you kind of could position yourself a little different because you knew he would get balls that maybe somebody else couldn't get.
Did you ever swing one of Julio Franco's bats?
I did. I have one actually in my basement, and it's a treat. I mean, it's a big old fat tree limb. And, you know, what people don't realize, you know, he used a 36-36, but he wrapped two fingers under the knob. So his pinky and his ring finger were under the knob. So basically, he's probably swinging almost a 38-inch bat when it comes down to it. But, I mean, he is just a different specimen. He's built different. I mean, those guys are just built different. It's kind of like the Otanis and all them today. Like, there's really no explanation of what they are. They're just built different.
I've never asked a guy this. How do you decide what's your go-to bat? Because once you get to pro ball and wood bat, like, you know, in high school, you've got, like, there are four or five, like, hot aluminum bats that everyone has a variety. When you go to pro ball, you have, you know, any different weight or length you can pick up, any color, any type. Like, how did you land on these are my tools?
It's trial and error. In today's game, they have all the bat testing, so, you know, they kind of like see your swing with different models and which one's better for you. But You know, when I came up, it was more on let's find the handle that's comfortable. Let's find out if we want balanced, semi-end loaded or end loaded. And then you kind of your the game was your test. I mean, you basically tried different models, and whichever one you felt like you were more comfortable with in the game is what you went with. There was no one telling you what model to use. There was no testing. It was trial and error in the game. I mean, batting practice was trial and error in the game. I mean, you finally it, and it took probably. I mean, I went with an M110 my first part of my career, and then it was like, you know, 271. I think it took me probably 3 to 4 years before I figured out what I even needed to be swinging.
Do you think you would have rather had the bat testing, like a computer basically saying this is the bat that you perform best with, or did you like the trial and error aspect?
Oh, 100% would love to know right off the get-go because I think that helps you from the beginning. I mean, you know, because, you know, if you're going up to the plate facing the arms that are in pro ball and you're trying to figure out what bat you're supposed to use. I mean, I would much rather have known that early. Like, okay, hey, here's maybe two or three models that you need to try. Like, you know, these models I think are going to be good for you for the type of swing you have, the bat speed you have, all those kind of things go into play. So I would much rather have known if that stuff was around.
With the Braves, you kind of you fall into like a role player type thing where you're not getting the 500 at bats a year. You're kind of, you know, picking your spots or, you know, different games and things like that. How do you stay ready when you're not in the lineup card every day or know that like my only at bat might be in the seventh inning against this reliever or something like that? Like, what is your how do you build routine when your playing cadence is not routine?
I always say you gotta read the game. You kind of always, if you're not starting, you have to kind of know that you got, you know, even at the beginning of the game, you got to make sure you're moving around a little bit because I mean there could be an injury and you got to go in the game right away.
And that's back when pitchers hit too. So it's you're seeing, okay, when is, you know, Glavin's due up
Yes.
here, you know, I might be in.
Oh, for sure. Because I, you know, I played the National League my whole career, and this was before the DH. You know, you had to be ready to hit for the pitcher. So you kind of had to read the game. You had to see how the pitcher was pitching, who was coming up, who's, you know, does he have anybody warming up in the bullpen? But you got to start moving around that fourth or fifth inning. You got to start getting your juices flowing. You got to go to the cage, take some swings. You got to start stretching, you know, run up and down the tunnel, just get the blood flowing. Because the last thing you want to do is get caught off guard. You want to be ready when they call you. And that's the thing. It takes a lot of mental discipline because you might start getting ready in the fourth, but you might not hit till the ninth. You might not hit till the seventh or eighth. It's not like you're getting loose and here you go. That doesn't happen often. So it's a mental grind. You know, it's a little different than a bullpen guy, I would say, but it also is similar. There's some bullpen guys that know the role, then there's some bullpen guys that's like, hey, be ready when we call. And that's what it is to be a, you know, when you're not starting that day and you have to be ready to pinch hit or come in on defense. I mean, you just got to read the game. But also, that helped me basically study the game too, because I would kind of see what was going on in situations of what was Bobby Cox thinking, what was Joe Girardi thinking, what was Charlie Manuel thinking. Like, I started learning the game a lot better doing that.
What was the mentality shift like when you're traded from the Braves, traded from a perennial contender at that point to Milwaukee, which, you know, dead last, but you get 500 ABs. Is getting 500 ABs on that team better than getting 200-ish on a, you know, a playoff contender?
I mean, you know, I kind of straddle the fence. I mean, you 100% always want to be on a winning team. That's why we play the game. But you also understand, you know, for me to progress in my career, I have to get those at bats. I have to show that I can play this game not only as a role player, but also as a starter, because that helps you in arbitration. It helps you in a free agency. So, you know, it's not selfish. It's like, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, I 100% rather be on a winning team, but there's also times it's like, okay, this is my career. I've got to provide for my family, and one day this is going to be over, and I got to, you know, have the financial capabilities of living a life after baseball. So yeah, 100%. I straddle the fence a little bit on it, but I mean, I think that there are players sometimes that would, you know, tell you the same thing, like, yeah, I hated leaving Atlanta. I loved it. We were in a great spot there, but it was time for me to go and get those at bats.
What was watching Richie Sexson take BP like?
Oh, it was fun. It's fun because he's so tall. It's like, how do you get the barrel down in the zone to even hit that pitch in the strike zone? But yeah, it was fun. I mean, just a tall, lanky, wiry, you know, dude that, you know, could hit the ball a long way. I mean, he had some great years in Milwaukee, and, you know, to get to play with him and, you know, Jeff Jenkins and all those guys, I mean, you know, yeah, it was fun getting to play. Even though we didn't win a lot, it was definitely fun to get to play with him.
What was the difference in the kind of hitter you were? Like, you're walking to the plate, what's going through your mind when from, say, like 5-6 years in to from rookie year? Like, what, you know, what had changed in your development that made you say a better hitter?
I would say kind of not trying to do too much. When you're a rookie and, you know, there's all those things going through your mind, you're trying to impress, you're trying to show you belong here. You're young, especially in Atlanta, being a role guy, like when you got your opportunity, you wanted to like do well. So sometimes that puts more pressure to it. So you maybe, you know, are more aggressive than you should be early in the count. You might expand the zone before two strikes when you shouldn't, and stuff like that. Well, I think as I got older, I learned to be more selective, aggressive early in the count. Like, you know, I would sit on certain pitches or sit certain zones or sit certain, you know, like I would sit hard, you know, away or hard in or soft away or something like that. I was more selective, aggressive early in the count. And that helped me tremendously kind of just ease everything into not trying to do too much and letting basically my bat become, I'm going to take what the pitcher gives me, but when he makes a mistake, I've got to do damage on that mistake. And that came from just settling the nerves and not trying to do too much.
On the back end of your career, you spend those last few years in Miami, you're kind of back as like the role player. What's in the job description as the veteran role player? It's kind of like if you're a guy who's in your 30s and you're the veteran, it's kind of a given that like, hey, you need to be the clubhouse guy. You know, you need to, you know, how much of what's needed of you is on field versus off the field in the clubhouse? Like what kind of responsibilities did you put on yourself as one of the older guys on that team?
Yeah, I mean, actually my nickname in Florida was Uncle Wes. I became more of that father figure to the younger guys.
You're only in your early 30s too. It wasn't like you were Verlander who's like 41 or something like
I mean, you know, my first year in Florida, I mean, with Joe Girardi there in 06, we set the record. We had 9 starting rookies opening day on the field. And so, yeah, it was one of those roles where, hey, go do your thing, be the player you are, but also, you know, I want you to be the leader for these younger kids and show them the way to do things. And that's where I go back to the Braves days and all that, like growing up. I mean, not growing up, but coming up with the Braves and being there with them, knowing the Braves way kind of helped me a lot when I fell into that role in Florida of helping these kids, you know, understand like, hey, you're not just a baseball player. There's a certain way we do things. There's a certain way you handle yourself. There's a certain way you act. Those kind of things just kind of fell into my role when I was in Florida, not only to help the team win, but also kind of help these younger players understand the way things need to be done.
How much goes in? Is that like new guy comes up and you've got to, hey, we're going on a road trip. This is how you go about your business. This is where we should eat. You should, you know, get to the stadium by this. Like how much hand holding do you have to do? How much advice do you need to give to someone?
Well, you got to pick and choose. I mean, you know, there's times you say something, there's times you're not. I mean, it's more or less if you start to see something that, you know, is a concern, like, hey, I need to kind of maybe say something. I mean, you want them to kind of learn on their own as well, just because, you know, they're adults and, you know, you want them to like have that sense of, okay, I need to figure some things out on my own. But if it was something that I saw that was maybe a reflection on the organization or maybe not them not doing the things they needed to do to be the best player they could be, you know, I would talk to them about things like that. Like, you know, hey, why don't you think about this? You know, why don't be sure when you can do this to be careful, because that could, you know, be a black mark on your career or something like that. You know when to throw things at them and when not to. There's times to do it and times not to.
I have to ask, because Miami might be my favorite food city of the country. I have Cuban grandparents, so that's like what I grew up eating. You spent a couple years in Miami. I just have to ask, like, what's it like being a big leaguer in that food city?
Oh, it's great. I mean, Miami's one of those you can kind of get anything. You know, I know, you know, Latin food to, whatever cuisine you want. I know Prime 112 was one of our favorite restaurants to go to down there, kind of close to South Beach. A lot of the players would go there. I know the Miami Heat, all those guys go there as well. Prime 112, but just the Latin style food, like the Pollo Tropical. Like, I wish we had one of those here where, you get the chicken, the black beans, the rice, the plantains. I mean, that stuff is so good.
It's the
So yeah, you're
best.
right. There's some good food down there.
It's the best. Well, with that, again, you're in your early 30s. How did, like, your career, like, conveniently spanned almost an even decade, the 2000s. Like, how much did food, nutrition, workout, sleep, everything like that, like, what were the things that you were doing in your early 30s that maybe weren't as much of a priority in those early 20s?
Oh my gosh. I mean, the older you get, the more emphasis is put on nutrition for sure. Sleep. But we didn't have those resources as much when I was playing as they do now. Like, I know as at the end of my career, we started getting nutritionists and, chefs in the kitchen, stuff like that. So that started transitioning into the game when I started coming out of the game. So I wish I'd have had that at a younger age because, you do all this training, you're young, you're not gonna, put on fat because you're active all the time. And we just kind of wasn't educated on all that coming up. It was just, you go play, you eat, you do it again. And there was no logic behind, hey, why you shouldn't eat these foods and why you should eat these foods. And hydration was always a big thing, of course. I mean, hydration and stuff, but yeah, I mean, it was a lot different in my 30s. I noticed in my 30s, you just see the things you have to stay away from and things you need to kind of know that it's important for your body because, your body starts adapting to things differently as you get older. So, but I wish I'd have known a lot of the nutritional things and all that, when I got into pro ball, because I think that would have maybe have helped me as I went on. I'm not saying it made me play longer or anything, but it could have made my performance every day a little better. I mean, I don't know. It could have, it could not have, but I wish I'd have not had those resources.
Those last few Miami years, rebuilding franchise, not many, winning teams. You're in your 30s, you're not going to be a Hall of Famer. Might not find your way back to being a regular. What like I guess what brought you joy in coming back to the ballpark? Like, what was keeping you still coming there, every day to kind of in a role where it's like you got to scrap for your ABs?
Yeah, I mean, I just love the game so much. That was the thing, like I said, it was my job. So it's almost like you treat it like a job at that point where, early in your career, you still have that sense of it's just a game and all this. But once you get older, you start to realize that, this is my job. Like, and I'm almost to the point where I'm on my way out. So I got to kind of fight and scratch, go as long as I can before it ends. So it became more of a thing just to, more of a mindset of, hey, I mean, I'm in a position now where I'm kind of there's really not a lot of movement upward now. I'm kind of leveled out. My playing days are getting toward the end. You just got to kind of, it's a mindset of, telling yourself like, hey, just go take it all in until it's over. Do what you can to help the team win and do what you can to have yourself ready every single day. Because also I got enjoyment of, my kids. I mean, Wesley and Stella, my youngest didn't get to experience it as much, but like just them growing up watching me play, that kind of was always motivation for me as well.
I was gonna ask I'm sure there are benefits. I've talked to other parents on the show before. I'm sure there are benefits of being a big league dad and having all that stuff. But just like how, I don't think people think about like how difficult it is to parent when you're on the road for a solid 4 months of the year and you're gone.
No, it's, I mean, what we do, the military, all of this is kind of like in the same category to where, usually the moms are raising the kids majority of the time because we are gone so much. I mean, the good thing about us is we get to go home for 4.5 months and we get all that time. But once spring training hits and the season hits and playoffs, I mean, you're gone a week, sometimes 2 weeks, and you're home a week and then you're gone again. So it's the mom, that's raising the kids majority of the time. And, it's tough. I mean, because my wife and I talk about it all the time, they're like, when you come home, you're the play dad. And when you're gone, I'm the strict mom. And, because it's like when I come home, I want to play with my kids as much as possible. And you know, you're not that disciplinary like you need to be sometimes, and then all of a sudden you leave and the mom has to do all that. So it's kind of unfair to the wife and the mom sometimes, but it's a tough life. I mean, I always say it takes a special woman to be married to a professional athlete, and it's true. It really does. They have to be prepared for that.
Was there a moment you knew it was time to hang them up, or was it more of a gradual thing?
Yeah, I mean, that last year in Florida, and then I got let go, and then the Braves picked me up, and I had a heel injury that was just absolutely awful. I mean, I literally could not even hardly walk, and finally had to get in a boot after that season was over. I had to wear a boot for like 6 weeks just to kind of calm it down. It was more inflammation than anything, but it wasn't going to go away until I got off my foot. And that's when it kind of hit me, like, okay, is this the end? Funny thing, the new Braves manager, Walt Weiss, was the Colorado Rockies manager, and I played with Walt in Atlanta. And so I called him up and said, you know, hey, you know, if I want to give this one more go, would you let me come to spring training? And so he actually had a Colorado scout come to Birmingham, and I went up to a high school here and hit through, ran and stuff, and they're like, yeah, let's bring you in. And then I think it was not long after that, it was we kind of sat down as a family and talked about it. And I think we just made a family decision of, you know, you've played a long time, you've played 12 years in the big leagues. You know, the chances of you making the big league team with the Rockies are very slim. You're probably gonna have to go to the minor leagues. I think we just made a family decision,
Which is
like, hey,
was Colorado Springs at that point, I think, too,
yep.
which
It
is.
was Colorado Springs. So we just made a family decision to say, all right, this is it. And it was great. I mean, I kind of, after that, started coaching my son, and, you know, it was great. So it was bittersweet. I mean, I missed it, but it was also good timing, I think. I think everything happens for a reason.
If you could go back and give a pep talk to that 18-year-old version of yourself to sign with the Braves, what would that pep talk look like?
Oh man, I mean, I would basically, I don't know, it's tough to say. I mean, you know, I would basically say, you know, I always worked hard, so it wouldn't do anything about working hard. I would basically just say, like, look, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. You know, give it everything you have every single day. Don't get caught up in the things that distract you off the field that the pro life can bring at you. I think, you know, just go be Wes and go give it all you have and see how far you make it. And I think if everybody takes that, you know, that mindset, they don't get caught up in all the pressures. They just go work hard every day and they think day by day, the process rather than the big leagues. They don't think big leagues, think, hey, every day, take a step up the ladder. And one day, if it works out, you're going to be in the big leagues. If it doesn't, you know, you go do something else.
Got a little rapid fire for you, and I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah.
Favorite minor league stadium, and I would specify when you were playing because you managed in, I think, what's probably arguably the most beautiful stadium in the minor leagues right now.
That is true. I would say the best one would definitely be Durham.
No, I mean, yeah, classic.
Yeah.
Favorite big league stadium?
Oh, favorite big league stadium at the time when I played, 100% Busch Stadium. Just
It
because of
was
fans.
it was it, yeah, it was the current one. Too, right? Yeah.
Yes, I mean
Yeah.
just the fans. The fans are the best fans in baseball.
Toughest pitcher you ever faced?
Randy Johnson.
This isn't really rapid fire, but like, what you step in against Randy Johnson, like, what are you even looking for?
Oh, you pray and hope. It's kind of like facing Paul Skeens in today's game. You just pray you put the bat on the ball. I mean, and you pray that his slider doesn't hit you in the back foot, because it would start in the left-handed batter's box and it literally hits you in the back foot. So, yeah, you just there was not a com un that was not a comfortable bat at all.
Favorite home run you ever hit?
Billy Wagner in Houston. It was 489 feet. My furthest ball I ever hit. I hit it in the over the oranges in the train.
That's wonderful. Best food city in the big leagues.
Best food city, I would say. I mean, I have to say New York because, you know, they always say if you have a restaurant in New York, if it's not good, you're not going to make it. And it is true. Every restaurant there you go to, usually the food's really good.
Last one, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
No, but I have one from Venezuela when I played winter ball.
Oh,
I
yeah,
mean,
hit me with it.
so we're down there playing in winter ball. Of course, you bust everywhere, and we're on a long bus ride, and there was a detour. The road was blocked, and we had to take this dirt road through the middle of the jungle to get across to another highway. And it's about a 15-mile bus ride. Well, the bus overheated on the dirt road and it was dark. And basically, everybody's getting off the bus for a second to, go to the bathroom, just kind of hang out or whatever. And I'll never forget it. The bus driver said, "Hey, do not leave the bus. Make sure your hand is always touching the bus because there's anacondas out here about as long as this bus." And all I remember is that story. And we were stuck there for about an hour and a half until he was able to fix the bus to us to get to our next destination. And that was definitely the worst bus ride I've ever been a part of, because minor leagues, we had terrible bus rides, but never really one where we broke down or had anything like that happen.
You must have been lucky then, because there are a lot of bus rides. But that's fresh after the Anaconda movie came out too. So that's top of mind. Oof.
Oh yeah, and an American in a foreign country. It was just so many things going through your mind. Like, I might not make it out of here.
Yeah, I've heard really fun things about playing winter ball in Venezuela, and I've heard some things that seem a little cagier.
Yeah, Venezuela wasn't the safest. It's definitely not the safest now. I don't even think they allow Americans to go down there to play anymore, but it was definitely not the safest place. I mean, you had to be careful where you were going. You don't walk anywhere by yourself.
Yeah, well, Wes, that is all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom of the Farm.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's it for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm. Big thanks to Wes Helms for stopping by, walking us through his career journey. If you enjoyed this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we'll catch you in a month. Thanks for listening.